From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how a Las Vegas architect came to own the mid-Michigan dams that failed so spectacularly.
His presence in that community was very multifaceted, and certainly he was a controversial figure, to say the least.
We're speaking with one of the writers of a new investigative report. Also, an immigration attorney recounts the daily calls she's getting from migrant workers.
People have called and said, we don't want to say even where we're working, but this is what's happening, and can you give me an idea of what I can do about it, or where I can go for a test?
And writer Donovan Hone on some very modern metaphysical collisions.
When we have more information, more ways of understanding the world than we'll ever be able to explore in a lifetime, that coincides with a kind of distance from an actual firsthand knowledge of the natural world.
That and more on the way. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we're touching base on COVID outbreaks amongst agriculture workers and what some farmers are doing to keep their seasonal employees safe.
Before they get on the bus to go to the field, and when they get on the bus to come back from the field, we're sanitizing. The bus driver, after they get off the bus, sanitizes all the places, you know, where they could touch on the way in or out. And we're doing the best we can.
But first, flood cleanup continues today in and around Midland County. Contractors are starting to get to homes and businesses, but it's estimated full repairs could take as much as a year. The failure of the Edenville and Sanford dams will cost millions to the 10,000 residents who ran from the floodwaters last week. Everyone in the region has very pointed questions about why the private owners of the dams allowed them to fall into disrepair. Bridge Magazine just published a remarkable article that sheds some light on the owner's story. Kelly House is part of the reporting team that worked on the piece. Kelly, welcome to Stateside.
Hi. Thanks, April. Good to be here.
Your colleague Mike Wilkinson went through federal court records that showed federal regulators were well aware of the state of the dams and, in fact, had been fighting the owners for years. How far back does the dispute go?
That goes back to at least 1993, according to FERC records. And that is, you know, predating Boyce, the current owner, Boyce Hydro's ownership of these dams. So it goes back multiple owners and until at least the mid-90s.
So you and the team focused on a couple of owners, Lee Muller, a guy who lives in Las Vegas, an architect, and his cousin, Michel Davinat, who lives in California. Can you tell us a little bit about who they are?
Yes. So they are both, interestingly, heirs to the founder of the Boy Scouts of America, William D. Boyce. And it appears that when Boyce died, his fortune was placed in a trust that this was in the 1920s. Eventually, these two cousins became trustees of this money. And, you know, essentially came to own the dams in Midland because they had sold other property owned by the trust and were seeking another investment.
As a tax shelter, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. What were the first signs of trouble over the dam's maintenance that you guys were able to find?
Well, again, that trouble began, you know, back in the 90s. FERC had been warning owners for decades.
That's the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Yes. So these federal regulators had been warning for decades that there were issues with the spillway. Essentially, the spillway was not large enough to pass the probable maximum flood. And because this is a high hazard dam, meaning that if, you know, it were to fail, there would be potential loss of life downstream. FERC wanted this dam to be able to handle 100% of probable maximum flood. Again, problems that began before Muller and Boyce took ownership of this dam, but records show that, you know, once these guys were the owners, there were constant communications with FERC about needed repairs and upgrades and repeated refusal to do it. The Boyce Trust basically claimed that they did not have the money to do these repairs. And that was a repeated claim, ultimately resulting in federal regulators yanking the license for one of the dams, Edenville Dam, which is the one that failed in 2018.
Is there any way of evaluating Lee Mueller's claims that there just wasn't enough money to do this?
You know, we don't have a clear sense of that right now. What we do know is that, you know, stemming from separate lawsuits related to the dams, Mueller had claimed that the dams were not making enough money. And in our reporting, we found that they were, you know, it appeared they were making about a couple of million per year in selling electricity. What's not clear is, you know, whether the net gain from that was indeed enough or not enough to pull off these repairs.
It seemed at one point the Boyce Trust was claiming that the dam was one of I believe the Edenville Dam was losing like $6,000 a day, but I guess we don't have a full internal accounting of the finances, right?
Correct. And that claim was made after federal regulators revoked the license to generate power. So, you know, Mueller essentially claimed without the ability to generate power, now we are actively losing money.
Kelly, why do you have a bigger sense of why the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission was not able to force the trust into action? I mean, they clearly invested lots of time and legal activity in this.
Yeah, and that is not clear. We've sent a lot of questions to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission on this, haven't gotten clear answers on why it took decades to finally revoke this license and, you know, whether there were other avenues of recourse that were not pursued.
We know, as you say, that FERC did force the owners to stop generating electricity there about a year and a half ago. In hindsight, do you think the reporting shows that was a mistake in terms of what happened with the flooding?
That is also not clear. Mueller certainly seemed to think it was a mistake, you know, both in arguing that with the inability to run water through the turbines, which is how it generates electricity, you know, Mueller argued that basically reduced the dam's overall ability to pass water and therefore heightened flood risk. He also made the argument that, you know, if there was ever any hope of these needed upgrades and repairs being made, that hope had been dashed by the inability to generate money on the dam. Essentially, he was arguing, without money coming in, now I certainly can't repair this.
Lee Mueller actually used to own some property on the lakes near the dams. And we can see from your article, he was not particularly beloved in the area. At one point, he pleaded to misdemeanor charges for ramming his truck into some local residents' vehicles. He said they were fishing on his property. Is there any reason to think that he or the Boyce Trust or any of its members might face some additional repercussions now that this terrible flood, you know, that the worst has happened?
Yes, I think there is the possibility of that. There are multiple class action lawsuits, being pursued at this point that do name Mueller and the trust. So certainly there are efforts underway to, you know, pursue some accountability for him specifically and the trust specifically.
Yeah. This whole story, what you've laid out, is so remarkable to think that people who live on the other side of the country, you know, the one of them, a professional architect who really is not very involved in water infrastructure, and the other, Lee Mueller's cousin, Michelle Davina, is a professional musician who plays the bagpipes and has a sort of a minor title due to the fact that one of his parents was French royalty. I mean, it's a very odd way to run infrastructure. Do you get any sense that because of problems like the Midland County flooding, that FERC might be taking a different view about private ownership of something like a dam?
Well, certainly there are, you know, a lot of experts will tell you that private dam ownership is a big obstacle. And for reasons you just highlighted, you know, when infrastructure that was initially created for one reason in a very different time.
A public good. Yeah.
Exactly. A good that has at least become a public good. You know, in the century plus since this dam was built, you've had communities sprout up around it. It's become a recreational haven. It now, and, you know, downstream communities that are at extreme risk if this thing fails. So, you know, experts definitely have raised that issue of viewing public infrastructure or publicly used infrastructure as a private investment. Again, unclear from FERC whether or not this will change anything about their regulation in the future. They haven't, to my knowledge, offered any, you know, perspective on that so far.
Do you have any sense of how widespread, you know, how many other Boyce trusts there might be out there?
In Michigan, I believe we had the figure in our story. There are 2,600 dams in Michigan, and of those, about three quarters are privately owned. So it's, you know, I think it would be surprising to many people that a, you know, large majority of the dams in our state are privately owned. To what extent those are under, you know, the same risk that Edenville Dam was, that's less clear.
Kelly, do you think the problems with the dams were essentially something that was hiding in plain sight to folks in the area?
You know, one thing that became very clear in reporting out this story is just, you know, sort of the longstanding and multifaceted controversy that this Mueller owner presented in this community between criminal, you know, cases stemming from the way that he wanted to keep, you know, block public access to the dams, to tax issues, to the dam maintenance. You know, his presence in that community was very multifaceted, and certainly he was a controversial figure, to say the least.
Kelly House is a reporter with Bridge, Michigan. She was part of the reporting team that published an article on the heirs who bought the Midland dams as a tax shelter in advance of the flooding last week. Kelly, thanks for your time and thanks for the story. It's kind of amazing.
Thanks, April. Appreciate it.
Water has immense destructive power, but it also works as a medium and as an intersection. In a moment, writer Donovan Hone talks about the inner coast explored in his new essay collection and what he's learned about connection. That's after the break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Writer Donovan Hone's preoccupations with water mirror those that many of us who live in the Great Lakes carry around. He thinks about coastlines as messy places where different kinds of lives collide with each other. He thinks about fresh water, the most essential substance on Earth, and how far out of reach it is for so many of us. Hone, who teaches creative writing at Wayne State University, has written and edited for a slew of A-list publications like the New York Times, Harper's, and GQ. And he has a way of drilling down on details in ways that open up much broader ideas. He's just published a collection of essays called The Inner Coast, and he joins us from his home in Washtenaw County. Donovan Hone, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you, April.
You lead off the book with a long essay about a relative of yours, Tom, who collects tools. And you early on cop to the suspicion that tool collectors may be motivated by slightly odd feelings and that they're, you know, they're definitely an unusual bunch. But you grow fascinated through the essay by Tom's fascination with tools. And you note some of the fetishized aspects of tool history, the proliferation of tools and what it says about skilled labor in America during the first few hundred years. And there was this time when America's top tool was the wood plane, when woodcraft was sort of the dominant hand industry. And then you bring us along through the rise of the wrench and industrialization and mechanization. Could you read for us from a point in this, maybe set up the reading as well?
Yeah, so this is a passage that comes in response to a book by Eric Sloan, who was at the time a kind of a classic historian of antique woodworking tools. Here's the passage. Time, it seems, is an ironist. That spring, factory workers were being laid off in record numbers. Michigan alone had lost 171,000 manufacturing jobs in the previous 4 years, and the riveters and machine operators Eric Sloan derided seemed like skilled artisans compared with the technicians and sales associates replacing them. The era of the wrench, like the era of the plane before it, is ending. Predictably, the ranks of wrench collectors recently have begun to swell. Although still worth far less than a desirable plane, a rare and pristine John Deere tractor wrench can now fetch hundreds of dollars at auction. Partly, this reflects the enthusiasm in rural America for the antique tractors with which such wrenches were originally sold. But the popularity of other wrench varieties, pipe wrenches, automobile wrenches, buggy wrenches, battery cable pulling wrenches, is also growing. The decline of American manufacturing has given rise to pastoralism's post-industrial analog, A Romance of Rust.
That's Donovan Hone reading from an essay in The Inner Coast, his book just published. Donovan, what does that Romance of Rust tell you about who we are and where we are right now?
I think that part of what was fascinating to me when I was traveling with my uncle Tom, who was a botanist, he was collecting these tools from estate auctions, from condemned factories, and he would taxonomize them, almost treat them like they were zoological specimens, which is a very different way of looking at these artifacts of America's material history than how many collectors look at them. For many collectors, I think that the act of collecting, there's a yearning for the kind of lost knowledge and lost time, an attempt to preserve it in the form of the objects. And they were amazingly beautiful, actually, many of these tools. My uncle never wanted to restore them. He never wanted to touch them up with paint. He wanted to keep them in their actual state. So you could sometimes see places where a laborer's sweaty palm had left a mark in the oxidation of the metal. So I think that for me, that there's a way in which these tools came to kind of make visible to us something that's hard to see otherwise, which is the pace of technological change over the last century. That's, I think, what drew me into it. And how do we think about that change in ways that isn't nostalgic, that's clear-eyed, but also how do we reckon with the genuine loss, I think, of all that labor and all that knowledge that those tools held?
Your writing style has a fantastic kind of elastic quality to it. You're giving us these scenes from bouncing around to estate sales and other places with Tom, but also sort of taking us down the wormhole into Sloan's historical research into this, you know, warts and all. You don't really get caught up in an over-linear telling of your story, and you're great about just jetting what you're supposed to be talking about in favor of what you find really interesting. Has that been a hard thing to learn how to pull off as a writer?
When I was a graduate student in poetry, of all things, there was the poet Frank Bidart, actually, whom I quote in this particular essay, had this really nice, helpful thing, which he said that after you've learned how other minds make meaning, you have to learn how your mind makes meaning. And I have found that for me, that I always need to be doing both. For me, the essays I love as a reader, but also that I've tried to learn to write, will take us on journeys, tell stories, help us meet people who are fun to read about. But there's always a kind of an attempt to make sense of something that's accompanying that journey, that narrative. And that's just kind of how my brain works, I think.
This is a collection of essays that appeared in a lot of different publications over really many years. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of pulling them together and anything you noticed?
Well, at Wayne State University, where I teach writing now, I teach a course on the essay collection as theme and variation. So I almost think of it as if we're thinking about like a piece of music, a Bach fugue or whatever, where you kind of introduce a theme and then you try to complicate it and complicate it and complicate it. And I think there's a way in which I'm trying to do that, at least in this essay collection. One thing that's unusual for me, though, is I wrote them over many years. And I think the more one writes, the more one realizes that we can't quite ever escape our own preoccupations. You almost don't have to try. The themes or ideas or geographies that you keep returning to, kind of, they're a little bit mysterious in their origins, but they're there. So they emerged over the course of these. The first earliest essay in the book I wrote probably in the year 2000. So it's almost 20 years of these.
As you're talking about the essential qualities of water, you also point out the ways in which humanity or Western civilization has sort of stopped thinking about that. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, this is fascinating. There's a paradox to me, which is at a time when we have more information, more ways of understanding the world than we'll ever be able to explore in a lifetime. I mean, we could go onto Google Earth and look at every river and body of water on the planet now and from the safety of our desk. That coincides with a kind of distance or alienation from an actual kind of firsthand, intimate knowledge of I think, much of the natural world. So we can watch a BBC's Blue Planet and see things that are under the waves, but to actually experience it or study a river the way people did when they had to navigate them, that kind of knowledge, I think, has become increasingly abstract. It's even in our landscapes, I feel like, except for some picturesque waterfronts, that much of the water, many of the waterways of the interior have kind of receded from view. So there were, in a number of these essays, I'm trying to bring back the view from the water.
You've done some writing about the Flint water crisis.
Yeah.
And in this collection, we find your essay, The Zealot, which is about Mark Edwards, the Virginia Tech professor who became one of the leading critics of Flint in the water crisis. How did you meet him?
Well, so when I started talking to my editors at the Times Magazine about writing about him and the water crisis, frankly, Michigan Radio had done such wonderful reporting. The story was, this was early 2016 when finally the news was really getting out into the world. But Edwards was an interesting figure to me. What interested me most about his work was that in my experience, having written about lots of different scientists, especially in my first book, that there's a real tension often in the sciences between kind of pure science there as a detached observer doing research and any kind of advocacy or activism. So that's the main reason I was curious about him, because he was somebody who was very vocal in his advocacy. Those were kind of, that tension was what I kind of wanted to think through and explore in that piece.
You trace a bit of his journey from, in his words, sort of a regular college professor to something of a lightning rod, calling out problems in Flint and, as you say, taking more of an advocacy stance. But what a lot of people may not have known about him, at least outside of Flint, is that Edwards is also a conservative Republican who's much more concerned about misconduct in public institutions than in private ones. What did you learn about how he is seen within the field as you were working on this?
Well, in some ways that made him even more interesting, because it certainly, I think, went against my assumptions going in, that he has this kind of libertarian streak in his politics. And, you know, I wanted to spend time with him in order to understand how to reconcile both. I mean, I think he's got a very sincere concern about environmental justice, and he'll say that, you know, he got into his field because of concern about what had happened to the Great Lakes when he was growing up, and he'd witnessed Lake Erie get kind of saved by the Clean Water Act. And so those things can be reconciled. But I think the other thing that was fascinating to me was watching how much of a deft storyteller he was. And I felt that in some ways that the storytelling could maybe be complicated. When I visited him, a book on his floor in the place where he lives in Virginia, it was a book kind of as a horrible title. It was called Houston, We Need a Narrative. And it was by a scientist turned screenwriter, kind of telling people how to use the methods of Hollywood storytelling to help communicate science to the public. And I think that in some ways, the more I spent time with him, I think that I felt that the storytelling tended to be a little bit scripted in that kind of classic villains and victims kind of way.
Right.
So that's what I was trying to make sense of.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Donovan Hone. His new book is a collection of essays from the past decade or so. It's called The Inner Coast. You write at some length in one of the essays in the book, Falling, about your childhood, growing up outside of San Francisco on Mount Davidson. Could you tell us a little bit about your parents?
Yeah, I could. Well, you know, my father grew up in a town called Philo, Illinois, which almost has, it almost sounds like a ridiculously idyllic name for a small town on the plains of Illinois. But really in his side of the family, there was a devotion to the public university. My grandmother was the first in her family to go to college, and it was on a scholarship to the University of Illinois. And he decided in the 60s to do a medical career and ended up in academic medicine, which carried him to California eventually for a residency in San Francisco. My mother's family was very itinerant. She was an Air Force brat. My grandfather was a colonel. But after his military career, he too ended up in Central Illinois, which is where she met my father. And she, even before he went out to California, had a real, in her youth, a real kind of wanderlust and energy that I think made her restless. And she actually bicycled across the Western United States from Milwaukee to Northern California.
At a time when that was not done, especially by single women.
No, yeah, it was 1963 that she did it. She was a young 20-something. She had a buddy for the first part of it, but from the Rocky Mountains to the coast, she was solo. No, it was gutsy and impressive. And that's how she ended up out in on the coast of California. She'd had a dream that she was going to hop a steamship across the Pacific to reunite with a boy she'd met at a Red Cross training camp in Japan. It was a Korean boy she'd met, and she had been dreaming of reuniting with him, and that journey was interrupted, and I am the result of the interruption.
Your parents had a very difficult marriage.
They did.
And your mother actually ran away for a while when you and your brother were small kids. There are some really heartbreaking passages in this essay about her time away. Do you mind reading a little bit?
No, I don't. I'll just say she was, you know, this was part of the project for me in this essay was trying to understand her departures. And the easy way to understand them might be to say that she was clinically depressive, which I believe she was. But for her, it was much more than that. She had experienced a kind of crisis of faith after a very religious upbringing. And I wanted to write as empathetically about her experience and my own, which was difficult. So here's a passage. The year before we moved to the mountain, when I was almost 3 and my brother was 5, our mother had run away. For 9 months, or was it 8 or 6, testimonies conflict as they always do, memories fail as they always do. The record, as always, is unclear. She'd lived by herself in a boarding hotel near the train yards of South San Francisco. The first night she was gone, I woke up terrified that something horrible had befallen us. Above me, the mattress of my brother's bunk had begun to shed its gauzy underside, which hung down in strings that I liked to pluck at, making them longer. Atop the dresser, our fish tank gurgled and glowed. A year later, on the morning we moved to Mount Davidson, I would try to carry it, still full of water, out to the truck and succeed only in dunking the lid far enough for the bulb inside to electrify the tank's lonely resident, a zebrafish, which on the night my mother left drifted obliviously through plastic kelp, a rebuke to the hysteria that had awakened me. Uncharacteristically brave in the darkness, I conducted a thorough investigation of the premises. In the bedroom where my mother usually could be found, my giant father, snoring and alone, sprawled diagonally atop the tangled sheets as if dropped there from a great height. I looked in closets, under furniture, even inside the dishwasher, from which I distinctly remember steam rose.
What do you tell your students about taking on uncomfortable subjects?
Oh, lots of things. And it kind of depends on the subject, and it kind of depends on their relationship to the subject. If we're thinking about writing about painfully personal material, I think it's not uncommon that sometimes as writers we need a certain amount of distance. Really, I think this was able to write this essay, began working on it, I think, when I was around 30, and it took a while. So there was a distance from it. I think that one always, when one is writing, in some ways I feel very much that this essay, more than any others, in the book is mine to tell. Certainly, it contains many of my earliest memories and experiences. But we never are just telling our own stories. That's, I think, one of the challenges. Our stories are always entangled with the world around us, whether it's with the lives of family members or neighbors or a polity. And so it takes a great deal of care in how one handles the stories, one's own stories, but also those of others. I think when writing about family members or loved ones, for me, there are two great dangers. One is that we might sentimentalize loved ones. And I do think that can be a form of dehumanizing them, simplifying them. And then, of course, I think sometimes in memoirs, there's a risk of we don't want to vilify. You'll lose the trust of the readers if it feels like we're settling some sort of score. So it takes it's a strange combination of great emotional empathy, but also a certain amount of detachment from one's own emotions, I think, to do it with the needed delicacy.
That's pretty Herculean, considering the subject matter that you're working with here. Donovan Hone's latest collection of essays is The Inner Coast, and it's available right now from Norton Books. It's the kind of read that really works if you're looking for something to disappear into right now. Donovan, thanks very much for talking with us.
April, thank you so much for having me.
After the break, how life on one Michigan farm has been disrupted by COVID-19. That's next. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The farther we get into growing season, the more complex life becomes for Michigan's farmers. They're trying to plant, in some cases harvest, at a time when the world is moving in slow motion, if at all. Fred Leitz and his brothers run Leitz Farms. It's a fourth-generation operation, growing blueberries, cucumbers, tomatoes, and apples in Sotus Township near Benton Harbor. And he joins us today. Fred, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you for having me, April.
Farmers have so much to think about just during a regular year, but now COVID-19. How are you and everybody else on the farm doing? I imagine it's been challenging.
April, it's been very challenging. It's like drinking from a fire hose. Everything we're doing and new things we have to do, and there for a while, things were coming from the state, things were coming from the federal government, things are coming from OSHA, all having to do with the COVID-19 and dealing with employees and our own family personal safety. And being a farm, we all multitask. We're all jack of all trades. And in the wintertime, my HR person and myself, we try to get everything ready to go. And so that when April comes around, we can just start doing our thing getting the planting schedules, the planting and everything done. And then this happened, and it's just added to the burden.
Can you tell us a little bit about the size of the operation? And I know this is a product of several generations worth of Leitz's work, but how long have you been growing?
Oh, my gosh. I was raised here, and my brothers were too. We've been here our whole life, doing things on the farm. We're our biggest crop is tomatoes, and we break that down by grape tomatoes, Roma tomatoes, and the round tomatoes like you buy in the store. Everything we do is fresh market. Everything is hand picked. We're about 700 acres of intensive crops.
We know that there are labor shortages on farms already. But could you tell us what your workforce looks like right now?
Right now, we have about 46 H-2A visa workers from Mexico. They come in on the H-2A program. And we have, 15 or 16 domestic migrants that came out of Florida. And then we have some seasonal workers that are our local people who just come and work for the season. And then we have our full-time employees. So we're about 80 people right now. And we'll ramp up by mid-July to 225, 230 people.
The 40 folks who are H-2A, was everyone able to get here on time?
Yes. We got, being a contract, you work with recruiters in Mexico, you pay recruiters to find you the people. And everyone that's here this year has been here at least two previous years. So it was nice to have a workforce that was trained to know what we do. They had no problems. They've had their documents before. There's been no interviews at the embassy because of the COVID-19. But if you've been here previously and you've got a good visa and you've been in the H-2A or H-2B program, they allow you to get your visa renewed and come right in.
How are you keeping workers safe right now?
Well, we're doing all we can. I mean, out in the field, everybody wears a mask. It's pretty easy to social distance and self-distance out in the field. We haven't had anything close in the packing sheds or anything. None of that's going on for at least a month. At that point, then we'll make sure we'll be providing face masks a couple times a day and trying to distance the best we can. Going into town, you know, we're sanitizing people's hands before they get on the bus to go to the field. And when they get on the bus to come back from the field, we're sanitizing. The bus driver, after they get off the bus, sanitizes all the places, you know, where they could touch on the way in or out. And we're doing the best we can.
Yeah. Can I ask, I mean, in terms of where you are in the season right now, when you get to the end of the day and you have a minute to think about everything, what are your concerns about going into June and July about what's going to happen at the height of the season?
Well, I'm concerning myself more with marketing than with the COVID-19. I mean, we're going to do the best we can. We're going to have supplies on hand. We're going to do the training for the employees to keep them safe, us safe, our product safe, all that stuff. I'm more worried about markets and market conditions during that time because we do a lot of wholesale to institutional type people that go to the restaurants and the casinos and schools and stuff like that. So that's my biggest concern right now is being able to sell the product.
Right. The USDA announced recently that there could be more aid for farmers in store. But before that, there were the PPP loans for small businesses. Did you make an attempt to apply for any of those?
Yeah, I applied. I applied for some PPP money and got some. You could not use, when it first came out, you couldn't use the H-2A labor in your calculations.
Right.
And so I went. So I went and didn't use any H-2A labor. So that cut down. So it was. It was a small amount.
Mm-hmm.
And then I see where there were some banks and some other lending institutions that were reading it different during the second batch of PPP money, and they were letting the growers use H-2A labor. I was too early to get all that. Otherwise, I'd probably got a pretty good chunk, you know, and right away, my local congressman, Fred Upton's office, called to see what we were going to do. Senator Peter's office called. Senator Stabenow's office called. What are you farmers going to do? And I said, the way it looks to me, I should just sit it out and not do anything. And they all said, oh, you can't do that. You guys got to grow something or the American public will panic. And so right away, I said, okay, if you want us to grow, you got to make sure that there's a program or something in place that if I get all this out in the field and I can't harvest it because there's no markets or something happens where I have no labor because the COVID-19 has ramped up in Mexico and they closed the border, that I can be made whole. I can pay my bills. I don't need to make money, but I want to be able to pay my bills so I can do it again. And they all said, oh, we're going to make sure something happens and that you guys will be made whole and there'll be enough money in all the programs. And from what I'm seeing of program, that's the newest program, the CFAP or Farm Aid, Corona's Farm Aid program, it doesn't look like that's the answer either.
Fred, is there anything else you wish people understood better right now about the food supply chain?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of things. Number one, look for local grown, U.S. grown produce, okay? We need to make agriculture stronger and bigger again in the U.S. because I hate to be at the disadvantage of not growing enough here and then having something happen in Mexico or you have a different administration in Mexico and they don't want to sell to the U.S. because of something we did or something we do or something we won't agree to do. That's no way to have food security in this country, and that's a matter of national interest.
Fred Leitz of Leitz Farms in Sotus Township. Fred, thank you so much for your time today, and we wish you luck with the rest of the growing season.
Thank you, April. Call anytime.
Farmers have tried for decades to get some predictability in their workforce. It's been an uphill battle. Many of the emergency immigration bans happening right now do not affect migrant workers, but there are tons of other issues in the mix, not the least of which is COVID. Teresa Hendricks is director and senior litigator with Migrant Legal Aid, and she joins us now. Teresa, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Can you tell us, first of all, how often are you getting calls from workers who have health and safety concerns?
Oh my gosh, I am at this point, before the season has really even gotten started, I'm mentally drained, I'm overwhelmed, and I'm exhausted. We have so many phone calls, and the people that are calling are scared out of their minds like I've never seen in 24 years that I've been doing this.
Wow.
It's just, it's something new and difficult to deal with because of the onslaught of the amount of people calling.
What kinds of things are they concerned about? Just like conditions that frighten them or active outbreaks?
Active outbreaks, worried about people not enforcing safety measures at their facility. There's a widely differing approach to safety for the workers depending on what company they're working for. And now we're even finding that depending on if it's a large company, it can vary between supervisor or line boss in how much enforcement there is of the safety measures. But the immigrants that usually harvest our food usually live in family situations with multi-generations. So they're worried about anybody bringing home the illness to the children or to the in-laws or elderly people living in their household. And they just don't know where to turn to. And they're too afraid to lose their job to not report even when there's an outbreak or a lax of safety protocol.
Can you tell us a little bit about where the notable outbreaks have happened? I know about one at the Herbrooks Poultry Ranch, but what else is on your radar?
We've gotten phone calls from egg-producing facilities, from not only Herbrooks, but the Hudsonville location of Sunrise Acres, and the meatpacking plant at JBS, we know, has had over 100 people infected. And there's many other places where people have called and said, we don't want to say even where we're working, but this is what's happening, and can you give me an idea of what I can do about it or where I can go for a test?
Is there anything that you can tell them to help them?
Yes, I try to tell them that they have the right, you know, I go through their rights and responsibilities during this pandemic, and I offer them usually some options about what they'd like us to do, anything from making a communication with their employer and not naming them to calling the health department, and then we have some other options, like I can trigger my Fair Food program, or I can send them masks. We have people sending us $5 per farm worker, and I can send a whole safety kit to them, which includes masks and gloves and antibacterial gel. And then I can give them some Spanish language material that can help them understand things. But mostly they want to know what is the most that they can do to protect their family, and how much at risk does that put them of losing their job. So they're doing this constant balancing of their basic needs.
Some employers, like Fred Leitz, are doing the right things, but as you say, there are some taking a much less stringent approach to safety. Are there any mandated protections for farm workers and food supply workers if an employer isn't providing PPE, if an employer isn't providing sanitary housing conditions?
Well, that's the $1,000 question. There are CDC guidelines, depending on what kind of facility you run, whether it's a meat packing plant or a food processing plant or in the fields. But enforcement is spotty. I mean, I don't know how we have enough to enforce everybody's work environment. And so you'll find spotty enforcement, if any. And we're just all trying to work together between health departments and food and safety professionals to try to do what we can to keep the workplace safe. These workers are at extremely high risk because of the nature of their work.
When you say the nature of their work, can you give us an overview of some of the conditions that we might be talking about for Michigan's migrant workers?
Sure, it'll depend on crop. So let's take asparagus. You sit on a tractor and shoulder to shoulder, basically, for, you know, from dawn till dusk, harvesting asparagus right next to your coworkers. When we move to the blueberries, you're going to be using the same weigh station, and you're going to be dumping and weighing your blueberries, sometimes standing in line. And then oftentimes when they're picking apples, they're picking in pairs, and so they're constantly working with someone else. And then their living conditions, oftentimes they're bunk beds. They're certainly not 6 feet apart. Sometimes they have to share common facilities like kitchens and refrigerators and bathrooms and laundry facilities.
So what's the situation for workers who do get sick? Do they necessarily have options for a clinic or healthcare?
Well, if the employer is following the rules, then they would give them time off, paid, and they would allow them to get the test. And now any farm worker can get a test. They don't have to be symptomatic. And so they need to know where they can go to get the test, that they will be covered for their time off from work while they're waiting for the test results. But once they test negative or when they're cleared of the virus, there's really not a lot of protections if they don't go back to work to protecting their job. And so they're being told, you know, we probably might hire you back, but it's no guarantee.
Teresa, what kind of damage could we be looking at if farms aren't working to ensure more protective regulations for their workers?
I think we could be in a catastrophic situation where we're looking at half the amount of produce that we usually come up with. Not only because the social distancing is going to cut down on the amount of product that can be put out in the same time frame, but also even farms that are complying and have controlled the outbreak, they're still going to have difficulty getting the same production out. So I think we are risking about half the production. And we have, I think the market value of our crops in Michigan that are hand-harvested is $11 billion, according to the state's numbers.
We've already seen, you know, some outbreaks that got national attention among pork producers or chicken ranches. Do you feel like any lessons have been learned? I mean, did that serve as sort of a wake-up call within regulatory circles about this?
I don't see that so much in Michigan. I don't see a lot of enforcement going on. I don't see any true consequences for people not following the rules or any results of any investigations. It might be because it's too early and it hasn't made it my way yet. But one thing I do know is that certain facilities that are dealing with animals have decided to proactively euthanize about half of their flock.
But that sounds more like a cut your losses kind of move.
Yeah, I think that's the idea is to they don't have enough workers to be able to process as much as they used to.
Right. How are you directing your advocacy to try to think through ways that might help the situation?
We normally are able to go out and do outreach directly at the camps, but we have to modify that. So I've been going on Spanish radio stations pretty regularly and for about an hour taking phone calls from people who are nervous or scared and don't want to give their name or maybe are asking on behalf of their whole company. And usually after I finish one of those, our phones ring off the hook with people that want follow-up information and want to go over their specific situation. We're also delivering the safety kits that we've come up with, which are the gloves and the masks and safety literature, which has all of our information on it and some resources. And so we're leaving those in the areas where normally we would have direct contact with workers. We're leaving them for them. And then people will call and request that we send them some safety kits as well. So, and we haven't even really begun the season, so I can't imagine where this is headed. I just hope that from this pandemic, one good thing would come out of it, and that would be that there's an increased respect for the risk that the farm workers put themselves at for their health and safety just to earn a living and provide us our food. And this pandemic is just on top of all of the other health hazards that they face. We have a pesticide safety program, but it doesn't prevent exposures that result in horrific complications for children and for families and medical bills. And so we're constantly trying to defend against regular health issues. And now this is just added exponentially to their burden and our responsibility to protect them.
Teresa Hendricks is director and senior litigator with Migrant Legal Aid. Teresa, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Stateside, some thoughts on which direction Big Ten football might be headed this fall. That's assuming it's headed anywhere.
These are big, complicated machines, and you don't just flip a switch at Labor Day and have football the next week.
Sports commentator John Eubacon joins us tomorrow. We hope you'll be here, too. That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you for listening. We'll see you on Friday.